Good morning and welcome to this November 2nd, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are under College Radio. I am your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and you are in for a treat. Gina Frangello is on with me now, and Francine Prose will be on in the second half talking about her latest novel. It's like novel number 22 or something. I don't even know anymore. It's way past 20. Mr. Monkey. But first, I am so happy to welcome Gina Frangello back to the show. Gina is the author of the Target Emerging Authors Selection, A Life in Men, which was a book club selection for Nylon magazine, The Rumpus and The Nervous Breakdown. She's also the author of two other books of fiction, Slut Lullabies, a Forward Magazine Best Book of the Year finalist, and My Sister's Continent. Her short fiction and essays and book reviews and journalism have been published all over the place, including Plowshares and the Boston Globe. She was on the show with me in 2012 for the anthology Men Undressed, and she was on the show with me in 2014 for A Life in Men. Podcasts of both those shows can be found on our website if you want to listen to those. Her latest novel is Every Kind of Wanting. It's published by Counterpoint, and it's going to drive our chat this morning. Gina, welcome back.
Thank you. It's so nice to be back on the show.
I love having you on. And, you know, we haven't chatted in a couple of years, and I'm such an avid follower of yours on Facebook and elsewhere. I'm a follower, not a stalker. Important distinction. but I know, you know, the last few years have been extremely tumultuous, so I'm I'm super happy to have you back on and to be still talking about books and fiction and the complicated stuff of life while you're living through the complicated stuff of life. So
yes, me too. I'm happy to be talking about books as well and to be back to that.
Yeah. And I want to talk about how all of how literature pulls us through some of the hard times. But first, why don't I give you a chance to talk about Every Kind of Wanting and kind of where this book came from and how it's been sustaining you, and, you know, tell us about these cast of characters.
So the novel is about, it centers on a gestational surrogacy, two men who want to become dads, and one of their older sisters donates an egg, and the other one's high school friend is the gestational surrogate who carries the egg. And so essentially these three couples come together to make what they call a community baby. And the novel's present-day action centers around all the conflicts and dramas that arise from that. But the characters all have complicated pasts, as we all do by the time we reach 40. And the novel actually spans about 30 years in time and goes back and forth between Venezuela and Miami, Beaver Island, Chicago, and into the pasts of the various characters, as well as what's happening now. And, you know, it was inspired by a few different things, I think, as any kind of ensemble cast novel is. I did have friends who did actual gestational surrogacy. They actually did two, and so that certainly was an inspiration. It was, you know, it was a very fascinating situation to see people coming together to try to have a child for another couple to raise. But you know, in a sense, that was the conceptual inspiration, and in reality, there were a lot of more personal inspirations. The death of one of my best friends in late 2011 happened very shortly before I began writing this novel, and I think the novel is very haunted by kind of the specter of, you know, death, cancer, mortality, things that I had just gone through with her at that time.
Right. You are so wonderful with character and complicated characters, and you never shy away from the risks and hard stuff. And I was wondering who gave you the most problem in this novel in the cast of characters. Who was the most difficult to access, and kind of how you worked through that with them?
So that's a really interesting question because, you know, obviously if you read the book, you know, there's a lot of point of view characters, and one of them, for example, is a man named Miguel, who is a guy who grew up in Venezuela. He's Latino, he's Puerto Rican and Cuban, and he is also gay. And so, of course, it's very it's a great challenge to take on a point of view that is so different from my own and my own background. And so, a lot of readers who read it assume that that must have been the most difficult thing in the novel, is to take on someone like Miguel. In reality, Miguel's background is very similar to one of my childhood best friends, and so I had him as really a guide to read the novel as I was going along, and to advise me and, you know, just talk through with me many of the issues that came up in the writing of that character. The most challenging character by far is actually a character who didn't appear as a point of view character until after I was working on revisions with Dan Smetanka, my editor at Counterpoint, which is Emily, the gestational surrogate. She did not have a point of view in the original version of the novel. She was just a character who was perceived through other characters' eyes. And after writing her and the ways that various other people in the cast had seen her, it was difficult to then figure out who she really was, not who they all imagined her to be. And I did that just starting last March when I was working on revisions. I had sold the book in late 2014, and Emily came much later to the, you know, to the actual final product than everybody else.
I do think it's such an interesting question about people's, you know, perceptions of people, their interior and their exterior. And, you know, we always say that adage about how we compare our insides to other people's outsides. And novels are really such a great way of comparing our insides to other people's insides. And that's kind of one of the only forms that you can do that, because, you know, even in film, you're not really getting people's interior. So
absolutely.
Your persona versus your, you know, whatever you grapple with inside, and how you project yourself to other people. I thought that was such an interesting question throughout this book of who we want to be and who we actually are.
Right. And what role we play in different people's lives, because we are all different depending on who is perceiving us and on what our kind of what our narrative is in that life, in that segment of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so interesting because I feel like women's relationships with each other are often so rich and satisfying because we try to do that. I think we try to share our interior lives, but of course, you know, it gets clouded by jealousy or by just lying to ourselves or lying to our friends.
Sure, sure.
All that stuff. I think these are all just such great questions. What I've really found interesting in the thing you just brought up about Miguel, is this question of representation and appropriation of characters, and the risk that, and I think you talked about this in another interview, of the risk of people coming to stand for things rather than just being their own characters and who they are, and they're complicated people. And I was wondering if you'd talk about that for a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's such a big issue in fiction. I mean, it's just a really big literary issue, I think. When characters who are anything other than sort of the perceived norm, and I use the word perceived because I think there's a difference between dominance and actual, you know, actual majority or actual norm. But I think characters who are anything other than kind of, you know, a white heterosexual man are often thought by readers, by critics, can be taken almost even unintentionally to represent everybody of their identity group. You know, so whether you're a man writing a female character and then critics say, oh, is this what this writer thinks that all women are like this, you know, or he's, you know, they're making a statement that this is what women think. You know, Miguel is a character who has numerous facets of his identity. So, I mean, he could be thought in that sense to represent all gay men. He could be thought to represent all Latino men. He could be thought to represent the immigrant experience. And, you know, meanwhile, he's just a person. You know, he's busy being an actual individual, and not his every action and every thought isn't about representing numerous entire groups of, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people on his shoulders. And so I think that that's just really important for writers to keep in mind, that we are not writing primarily, I mean, we may have political content in our work, but we are not writing a political treatise. We're not writing to educate. We're not writing to make a point. We're writing to actually have a real character, a breathing character who's a person. And so I think, you know, I think sometimes it can become really difficult to kind of escape that burden of representation and allow characters to be messy, to be full human beings, to make mistakes, to have demons, you know, because the writer can feel as though, oh, am I saying all women, all gay people, all, you know, people of this particular race are, you know, are like this, and wanting to almost present a utopian image in order to not be offensive, not to mislead the audience with a negative stereotype of some kind. And, you know, I just think it's a real struggle to try to figure out who is your character underneath all of those things, and that no individual character should have the burden of representing an entire identity group, and that every identity group has massive diversity within it. And, you know, our job is to find the empathy for the individual human.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the flip side of that question, I was having this conversation with a novelist the other day about appropriation, and she was saying how nervous she was. She was trying to write a novel about a Mexican 40s. So she had the tackle of time and the tackle mm-hmm. of place and the tackle of culture. And she's like, you know, it's just too much. It's too hard to do. And then what are people going to think of me, that I'm, you know, I'm not Mexican, and do I have the right to tell this story? And I thought that idea of having the right to tell a story is almost a dangerous question for novelists, because if you don't inhabit somebody else, you're just going to be writing a memoir your whole life, right?
It's true. It's complicated. You know, of course, we have to kind of interrogate, you know, what do I have the right to do? Who do I have the right to speak as? These things are complex. You know, I don't think there's an answer, in a sense. I mean, I know that as a writer, you don't want to be confined for, say, a 50-year career into, you know, writing nothing but characters like yourself. You don't want to essentially just write the same book over and over, the same autobiographical material over and over. You want to grow as a writer. You also, most of us were formed by books that took major risks. I wrote a piece on the Powell's blog on this topic, and one of the things that I talk about is that some of the writers who are taken to task now for having made mistakes in appropriation or representation, they did make mistakes. However, they also furthered dialogue. They also shattered boundaries. They also attempted to give voice to a lot of people who weren't being represented at the time, just using in terms of gender issues and in terms of representations of women, which is certainly something that was always very important to me and still is. A lot of male writers were writing female leads, female characters in their novels at a time when very few women had access to publishing books and access to being able to be heard and do those representations themselves. You know, so as much as we may now want to fault D.H. Lawrence or, you know, Flaubert or Tolstoy or anybody and say, oh, they, you know, how could these men be the ones who were accountable for how women were viewed in, you know, in the literary canon or what have you? If they hadn't been doing it, most women didn't really have the access to doing it themselves. We wouldn't have some of the great female characters in history. We wouldn't have enough, we wouldn't have enough women in literature. And so I think it's a dual thing. On the one hand, obviously, the huge goal is that, like women, we're able to ultimately tell our own stories. All groups need to be able to tell their own stories in far greater numbers than is currently the case in publishing. So publishing often will only have a very small handful of writers of color or, you know, gay writers coming out in a particular year or season, and it's sort of almost viewed as special topics, and that clearly has a long way to go before that changes and needs to change. That being said, I also don't think that that means that, okay, now that women are writing for ourselves, a male writer can never write about a female character anymore, or has nothing to contribute to that, you know, to that empathy or that understanding or that entering of another character's skin. I think that we all should try to be ambitious and empathic in our work, and that we try to understand the experiences of others, and we try to write and read in many ways to feel less alone and to broaden our worlds. So I think we really need to have a concurrent dialogue where people are able to speak for their own identity groups, and other writers are also able to be inclusive of those groups, and not confined only to who they are. And that goes for people of all identity groups. So obviously, you know, an Asian writer should be able to write as a white person or a Latino person, as well as, you know, not always feeling that they have the sole burden of, oh, well, I'm an Asian writer and there aren't enough Asian writers, so therefore I can only do this. I mean, by all means, you know, everyone should have the ability to follow their own passions and their own empathy with their work.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's funny because I talk to a lot of writers who seem to suggest that writing as far away from yourself as possible is very freeing, and sometimes those are the characters that come the easiest. And I like that. I like getting out of your own head. my guest this morning is Gina Frangello. The book is Every Kind of Wanting. It is published by Counterpoint, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I really enjoyed I wanted to talk a little bit about the structure of this. You have kind of what I guess you might call a prologue. So, but mm-hmm. I really like the way that it's set up is Act 3, Act 1, Act 2, Act 4.
Right.
So we're kind of set up a little bit off kilter, and I really enjoyed that. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about structuring the book, how you feel
Thanks.
About prologues. We have a big debate about prologues in our writers group. So,
well, you know, so of course it is. It is a strange prologue, right? It's basically a prologue that takes place sort of in the middle, and not so much in the middle, more towards the end, but not the end. The actual end goes 3 years beyond that. So what I was interested in, so the novel has a strange structure. Lena, who is one of the characters, the younger sister of Miguel, is kind of the overarching narrator of the entire book, but most of the book is told in third person, and her sections are told in second person, almost sort of epistolary style to her former lover, Nick. In a sense, in order for Lena to be able to enter the space of the other characters and enter the space of what happens, she needs a certain amount of foreknowledge. You know, she needs to be standing from a point further in the distance. And so I wasn't interested in a prologue that kind of began the action, because the style of the novel or the concept of the novel was that the character was telling the story from a point later down the line. But I also wanted there to be more that happened after she was done with kind of the main narrative of the story. So so it begins in Act 3, it goes back to Act 1 and 2, and it closes with Act 4. And the reason that I had acts rather than parts or chapters is that Lena's lover, Nick, is a playwright, and she is rather obsessed with him through most of the book and kind of emulating at various different points things that she's learned from him. And one of those things is she's acting in one of his plays at one point, and she structures one of the chapters as a play. So she's playing with that form a lot.
So good. I loved her character. She was...
Thank you.
She was wonderful. I want to talk a little bit about getting work done when life is intruding, and because I think a lot of writers, mm-hmm. whatever is happening in their lives, and you know, some more serious than other things, you know, writing can easily go by the wayside. And
absolutely,
yeah, I'd love to hear, you know, kind of writing through life,
so I mean, I'm not really writing very much right now, which is interesting. I mean, I've said, and, you know, you're probably aware from Facebook and et cetera, that I revised this novel in the middle of chemotherapy. And one of the questions that I've been getting a lot about the novel, because Lena and Miguel's older sister in the novel has cancer, and so there's an illness storyline in the novel, and a lot of people have been asking me how my cancer informed the writing of the novel. The truth is I sold the novel before I even had cancer. My best friend's death from cancer very much informed the novel, and, you know, a couple of years later I was diagnosed with breast cancer and ended up doing chemo, having a mastectomy, and so I did the revisions for Dan while I was in the middle of chemo, and I think that both Dan and I were a bit skeptical as to whether this was actually going to happen. You know, he kept saying, "Do you need me to bump the book? Do you need me to bump the book?" And really, I mean, I needed the book very much at that time. You know, it was not an easy period. I hadn't really known I was going to need chemo. I thought I was done after the surgery, and then it turned out that I needed it. And so, you know, the book very much was a way to get out of my own experience, but I think my experience also really colored the revision. The revision changed a lot, and I think that I had certain more intimate knowledge of things that I had already been writing about than I had when I had originally written them, and so that was interesting. But, you know, I mean, in all honesty, right now I have such a heavy teaching load that I'm writing a lot less than I was when I was in the middle of chemo, you know, so it's like you can't always know from the outside what sort of life event is going to pull you away from your writing. Sometimes it seems that something that would be completely devastating and preclude being able to do any creative work, you know, it doesn't turn out that way. And other times, I mean, my life is much more stable now, but, you know, I'm teaching 4 classes. I run a literary magazine. I have 3 children. I just really don't have a lot of time to write.
Right, right. Yeah, I was looking at your workload at some point, and I was like, I don't even understand how this is happening. But it also strikes me that living through all of this past couple of years would make you, I mean, you've always been such a fearless writer, but even more so, like, it feels like you just have less tolerance for the BS of, you know, whatever the publishing world throws at you or...
Yeah, I mean, I think there, you know, it's a cliche almost to say that when you have gone through something a little heavier than maybe, you know, the usual fare of your life, that, you know, you lose a little patience for the things that used to preoccupy you and seem like such a big deal. And I certainly have been still fresh enough in that experience that, you know, I mean, I'm not sitting there checking my Amazon rankings 25 times a day. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I realized the other day, I told my partner the other day, like, I haven't checked my rankings. Like, isn't that what a writer is supposed to, we're all supposed to be so obsessed with, you know, how's the book doing? Who's going to review the book? What's happening? And, you know, I don't want to say I'm not interested. I'm very interested in doing a good job for Counterpoint. I've done some touring. I love my editor. I love my publicist. You know, I love connecting with readers. I was in publishing for 20 years. You know, so all of that is still true. But I just, you know, I've always wanted to write what mattered to me. But I spent a lot of time worrying about the fact that because of my insistence on doing that, maybe, you know, I would never be commercial enough, I wouldn't sell enough, I wouldn't this or that, and I don't care anymore. I just want to write what I want to write, and I'm happy to have found some kindred spirits in the publishing world who seem to actually care about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm so happy you are writing and still going and doing all this important work, because it's you had an essay, I don't know, a couple of years ago about, it was this essay about a friend who is now gone. I don't think it was your best friend, but it was this, I think it was called "Did My Best Friend Really Know Me" or something.
Oh yeah, that was about my friend Kathy who died. Yeah, it came out in Dame and was syndicated in Salon, yeah.
Yeah, it was so good. I mean, I read it years ago, whenever it came out, maybe a couple
of
years ago.
It came out about a year and a half ago, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it really has stuck with me, and I was thinking of the power of, you know, I haven't gone back to reread it, but I was thinking the power of whatever the imagery in there was. You got at the emotion of something really true for me that has lingered for a couple of years. And I guess I should go back and match the words to whatever the lingering feeling is. But what a great testament to a writer to get something just right, even if it's, you know, whatever that sticky emotion is that has the ability to last and last through, you know, months and
thank you
of not reading it. It's really, that's really great. Anything that you are thinking, like novels on the horizon that have captured your interest?
I have a few different projects that, you know, that may be next, and I'm not really sure which of them is going to push.
Oops. See, we don't know what's coming next. She's going to leave us on a cliffhanger there.
But I have an essay collection that is in progress. I have a short story collection that is in progress. I have two different a novel I want to write. I have a possible nonfiction book I want to write. So, you know, it's my best guess right now which one is going to suddenly be urgent and make me stop my car and write things down in the notes of my phone or on a napkin.
That's crazy. Wow. Is that kind of how you always work with a bunch of balls in the air?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
that's insane. Any last-minute advice for us, advice for writers out there?
Well, I mean, there's, of course, so much one wants to tell writers, but, you know, I think really what we were just talking about in terms of being true to what you want to write and not trying to tailor yourself to the market, you know, if we just wanted a steady job and wanted to, you know, do what someone else expected of us, we could have been accountants, you know, and you know, or at least any sort of a steady day job that would be more predictable in our lives as artists and writers. I think that we're in this to follow our passion and our individual drive of what really haunts and compels us. And so I think people need to believe in their vision and keep going with it.
Yeah. You have a great website where people can follow you, and I know you're on Facebook.
Yes.
tell us where people can find you.
My website is just GinaFrangello.com. It gives some, you know, touring information on all my books, things like that. And yeah, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter as much as probably I should be, but yes, I'm around. I'm pretty easy to find, and I'm editing the Coachella Review these days too as the faculty editor. So you can find things that that my staff and I are passionate about there.
I love it. Gina, thanks so much for taking the time today. It's always great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me again. It was really nice to talk to you.
Really great. That was Gina Frangello. The book is Every Kind of Wanting. It is out and available now, published by Counterpoint. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Francine Prose will air in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We are streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. We are also on Twitter at Writers on Writing, or WOW. KUCI FM on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Stitcher. We're all over the place. If you go to Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, you can also find direct downloads of our show if you don't go through iTunes. There's a lot of other shows up there. There are upcoming shows. There are speaker series events. There's all kinds of stuff. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I recorded an interview with Francine Prose yesterday, so I'm going to run that now. And stay tuned. Francine Prose is the author of more than 20 works of fiction, including the New York Times bestselling novel Lovers at the Chameleon Club, which she was on this show with me talking about in April of 2014. A link to that podcast can be found on our website. Blue Angel was a finalist for the National Book Award. She's also written extensively in the nonfiction form, most notably about Anne Frank and her New York Times bestseller, Reading Like a Writer. She is a distinguished visiting writer at Bard College. Her latest novel is Mr. Monkey. It's published by HarperCollins, and we'll be chatting about it today. Francine, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show.
I love having you on the show. Every time I see you, you know, crossing across the airwaves again. I'm like, oh God, I got to get her back. I always have so much fun with you. So I have to tell you, when I initially read the premise of the book, read kind of the blurb, I thought only Francine Prose can pull this off, and you totally pulled it off. It was completely funny and engaging and often hilarious and poignant, all the things that I love in fiction, all the things I love about your writing. So I'm going to let
Thank you
kind
so
of,
much.
Yeah, I'm going to let you take us into it, and I'll let you kind of set up Mr. Monkey, take us inside both the play and the book.
Well, Mr. Monkey is a play. It's a musical for children, and it had its origins in another kids musical that I took my granddaughter to. And the real origin story is that we went to this play in off Broadway. And it was, in theory, this lighthearted kids musical, blah, blah. But actually, the budget was so low, and the actors were just breaking my heart because I knew that none of them had ever planned to wind up being in that play. So at some point, and my granddaughter, who was about 4 or 5 at the time, sensitive. So at some point in what she thought was a very noisy, raucous moment in the play, she said, "Grandma, are you interested in this?" And it was a silent moment in the theater, and everyone heard. So, and I said, yes, very loud. So that's how the book starts. So the book starts with one of the actresses in the play, a woman named Margot, who again was the star of her Yale drama class, and she had a big, bright future, she thought. And now she's playing a lawyer defending a monkey who's accused of larceny. And the play is based on a children's classic and so forth. And then... And I thought maybe she would be the novel. But with every chapter, every time I reached the end of a chapter, I realized that there was someone else that interested me. So the second chapter is written from the point of view of this 12-year-old boy who plays the monkey. And then I got to write about child actors and so forth. And then it just spun further and further out. I mean, there's a grandfather and grandson, naturally. They're me and my granddaughter, but if you change the gender, nobody recognizes you. Ha ha.
Right,
so,
right.
so they. It's about their point of view, and then it just keeps going further out. There's a teacher, the grandson's kindergarten teacher, is in there, and she goes on a date, and just by pure coincidence, she's sitting next to the guy who wrote the children's book on which the musical is based, and so forth and so on. And then I knew it had to circle back to the play, so it does. But, there are a lot of coincidences in the book. It's not as if I didn't notice. But I, so I had to kind of address that issue. But they are kind of, a number of weirdly coincidental things have been happening to me lately. So I guess they just happen.
Yeah, and part of me made the connection that this could only happen in New York. I mean, it's such a New York book, it feels like. Here in the bowels of Orange County, I mean, there are coincidences, but you're never going to be sitting next to the author of the book here, In New York, you might.
2 days ago, I went in just to get a cup of soup at the local bakery in the city, and this woman was sitting next to me talking to a friend, and then she asked me if I was Francine Prose. And I just assume I know everybody, but I don't remember them. And I said, yeah, do I know you? And she said, no, I recognize you. And then it turned out that my check for teaching at Bard College had about 3 months ago gone to the wrong address. And she was the person who had sent it back to me. And I sent her this effusive thank you note. So she'd recognized me from a picture, but nonetheless, she was the person who'd gotten my check and returned it to me. Coincidence?
Really?
Could be, yeah.
That's crazy. That's very
weird.
I know. That's very weird. I also like to talk about the, kind of the aboutness of books, apart from story and plot. This and this book is about so many things, as you kind of alluded to. It's loss and disappointment and faith and evolution and embarrassing erections. I mean, it's about so much stuff.
If you're 12.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the aboutness of this book for you, like after you'd finished writing it and you look back on it, kind of, what it was all about.
Well, it's funny because the chapter that everyone seems to be responding to most is the chapter from the grandfather's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt in the same way that my granddaughter said the thing that she wasn't supposed to say in the play,
I felt that every chapter in some way talks about something that you're not supposed to acknowledge, but I couldn't help it. I mean, one of the things the book is about is age, because all the young people in the book want to be older, and all the old people in the book want to be young again. So, the basic, grief and dissatisfaction that goes with age, but also the grandfather. I wanted to write about that relationship, which, everybody says, oh, grandkids, it's so wonderful, you can give them back, blah, blah, blah. But it's a lot more complicated than that. And I wanted to, I felt like I was pouring everything I knew into this book about art, about artistic failure, about hopes, about career, about, Darwin, evolution, first dates. I mean, it just kept kind of really pouring out of me.
Yeah.
And, in a book about a play about a monkey.
Right.
Who knew?
Right. Who knew? Yeah. And who knew as the reader starting it? I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. And then it just became so big that at the end I was like, man, that was about everything.
And it got kind of spiritual. I mean, that was what was surprising to me, was that, as I got into it, I realized it had this hugely spiritual, redemptive element to it, which I certainly wasn't planning in this writing about this awful play. And and by the end, there's this kind of message of hope and some kind of transcendence. And when I was writing it, I was as surprised as anybody else, as surprised as any reader. I went, really? But that's how it wound up.
Yeah. How much of it, I mean, by choosing a play that wasn't the play that you went to see about a monkey, did you know about that you were going to be talking about evolution and faith? And, I mean, did all of this come as a surprise to you as you were writing it?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I wish I were the kind of person who had it all planned out and a little neat little outline, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not. I mean, I had to invent another play because really my horror about this book is that any of the actors who were in the original play might possibly recognize themselves. So I had to invent a play that was as different from the real play, the original play, as I possibly could. And I don't know what, I was thinking a little about Curious George, although and once you write a kid's book about a monkey or pretend to write a kid's book, you have to address the Curious George problem. So, someone does in the novel talk about it as a piece of imperialist propaganda. So that I sort of began to think about, taking a monkey out of the wild and bringing him back to the, the city, so-called civilization. And it just so happened that it's a kind of a wonderful thing when you're writing, everything you see just somehow works its way into the book. I mean, there's a very, very brief reference to a documentary that the director of Mr. Monkey makes the cast watch, trying to work up some emotion for monkeys from them, about animals being killed in a game preserve in Africa. And it just so happened that, about 10 pages into the book, I streamed that documentary and watched it, and I went, okay, that's where this is going to go from here. So, everything got just put in there.
It's funny what a loaded symbol a monkey is that you don't I didn't really initially think about it until I got well into the book. But there are a lot of things that spin off of this monkey idea, including children's literature. But also, I like that in the play, we can't mention evolution. Like, that's a big taboo. And then, of course, it gets discussed throughout the rest of the book. But it is,
the thing you can't mention.
Yeah, the thing you can't mention is what we're all going to talk about. And which is so great for literature in general. I mean, isn't that what novels are? Is it's the thing that we don't talk about that we're now going to talk about in novels, because that's kind of a safe place to explore it.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, that's what I read some great quote from Zadie Smith. It's something like, one of the reasons I read is to feel less alone.
Yeah.
And I think that's really true. I think, the thing that you think about and the thing that you feel and that you think no one else has ever thought that or no one else has ever felt that way, you pick up a novel that addresses those two things, and it's such a comfort.
Exactly right. No, that's why I read, because it's all those weird ideas that you think nobody's ever thought this before, and I'm a freak for doing this, and you're like, oh,
right.
I'm not so much.
Not the only one.
Not the only one.
Yeah, in fact, there's another little scene in the book which happened probably 20 years ago, which is I went to the Bronx Zoo, and spend about half an hour watching this severely, understandably depressed gorilla. I just couldn't tear myself away. And that was 20 years ago, and only now did I find a way of using it in something I was writing.
Isn't that great? I think one of the great lessons from you, being as prolific as you are, is that everything in life is fodder for fiction. And even, you know, small incidents in your daily life can really feed your fiction. And I had read someplace where you had talked about, you know, if I worked 24 hours a day for the rest of my life, I still wouldn't be able to get done all the things that I really want to get done. And I have so many projects on my mind. And, you know, I heard tell of you wanting to do sort of a follow-up to How to Read Like a Writer, or Reading Like a Writer, that you just have so many ideas. And I think a lot of people really get stuck on, where do I get these ideas? And you have so many, you know, picture a photograph stimulating the lovers at the Chameleon Club. I mean, everything is so such rich fodder for you.
Well, you know, I was just reading, I'm teaching this class at Bard called Strange Books. So I was just reading this week's reading, and it's this, one of my favorite novels in the world. It's called Muriel Spark's Loitering with Intent. And she, I mean, it's the best book about, best novel about writing, about being a writer. And she talks about that in the book, and the way everything that happens, I mean, everything that, that she sees goes into her first novel, which she's writing at the time. I mean, it's so fantastic. Again, you know, to see that someplace else, I mean, I knew it from my own experience, but then to read a novel in which this is happening, I thought, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's great. My guest today is Francine Prose. The book is Mr. Monkey. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So the fact that your granddaughter actually said, Grandma, are you interested in this? I think it's both poignant. I don't know how old your granddaughter was when she said that, but it's just a great sentence construction, first of all.
Well, she and I are kind of arguing now about how old she was, because now, I don't know, she's pushed up the age at which this happened higher and higher. So she's been saying, I was 7. I mean, she feels that it's her book, which in a way it is. So, and I was going, there's no reason, she's 9 now. I'm going, there's no way you could have been 7, because this book was written earlier than 2 years. It began earlier than 2 years. I think she was about 4. I think she was about 4 or 5.
Wow.
Yeah, but again, because she's such a thoughtful, conscious little person, she was mortified because she knew that people in the theater, including the actors, had heard her. Right. So we had to work our way back from that one.
And I just love, you know, this question, because it's the big lingering question for all artists. You know, this, are you interested in this? You know, are you interested in this thing that I've poured my whole life and soul into? And this is the most important thing to me. And, you know, can I hold your attention for an hour and a half?
It's hugely important. I mean, you know, I don't know. I always think that everything is interesting if you look at it long enough. I honestly believe that every person is interesting if you can just figure out the right questions to ask.
Yeah, hopefully. I don't know. I've met a couple that I'm not so sure about.
Well, you have to, you know, sometimes a lot of work. But, you know, sooner or later, right, stepping over the bounds of politeness and so forth, you can find something that that you go, oh, really?
Right, right. Yeah, I just... I often in my own writing feel like I'm screaming out saying, is anyone interested in this? Am I the only person interested in this? And I really liked how it became, you know, sort of a source of embarrassment between them, and a kind of lie and a kind of secret. You know, it held all of this weight of, you know, what happened between them and that interchange. It was great.
I know. Also, it was one of those moments where the public and private collide in not the most comfortable way. I mean, it happens all the time, you know, but there was a kind of memorable one. And I think she'll remember it, you know, whether she wants to or not. She'll remember it now.
And I read somewhere that you were trying to write this book kind of, as you say, to her as sort of a way of not lying about, I'm really interested in this. I'm interested in something different than you think I'm interested in, but I'm interested.
Yeah, well, I was interested in a way perhaps different from what the actors might have hoped that I was interested in, but I was interested nonetheless.
Yeah, right. It's funny, as I was looking at the structure of this, it almost felt like interconnected short stories that, you know, there's the thing that brings them all together, but you really get to go into the kind of backstory and independent stories of each one of these characters. And I was wondering if...
that ever kind of entered your mind as a way to structure it?
You know, the way I thought of the structure was as if I had taken like a pebble and thrown it into a body of water, and then it just kept rippling out in these concentric circles, and then as the circles, you know, whatever circles do, it just came back to the center. Mm-hmm. Because it just spun out, and then I tried to make it spin back again. But I thought, you know, I have the whole city at my disposal, and I have everything. You know, there's a way in which, I mean, somebody described it as like a baton that's being passed from one character to the other. And I don't know, watching the Olympics this summer, I have to say that the baton, you know, whatever that relay race is, it was the one that made me most anxious, because I thought, you know, other people are depending on you to pick it up quickly. But that's how I thought of the narrative, that somehow each character would pick up something from the previous character and just take it further into someplace I wanted to go. And I really wasn't sure where I wanted to go, but I just had this sense. I mean, honestly, I've never felt so weirdly guided in some way as I did writing this book.
Mm. And you had to take on so many different points of view. You know, you write so effectively from a 12-year-old boy and from a, 70-plus-year-old man and from a teacher. And, you know, I mean, you really, really felt like you inhabited these characters all the way. And I was wondering if there were characters who gave you more problem, if the people who you identified with were more difficult to write about, like the grandfather figure being more difficult to write about because he was a little closer to your experience, or talk a little bit about who came easily, who came hard, and how you kind of went about accessing them.
The grandfather was actually easy because, as I said, I just poured myself into it. And it was also surprisingly easy to get in touch with my inner 12-year-old boy. He seems to be in there, so I just had to tap into him. As the book went on, it got harder because, I mean, near the end, there's an actress who whose day job is as an ER nurse. And somehow, I don't know, figuring out how someone could balance these two lives. I mean, I knew someone who was an ER nurse and an actress at the same time. But figuring out how this would actually work and how this would, you know, how someone could manage this was kind of difficult. And then thinking of the guy who wrote the novel, that was harder too. So so those were a little harder. But you know, I don't know. It was all just a pleasure finally.
It's funny, as you're saying that, I'm picturing, you know, your concentric circle analogy, and the closer to the center of the core you were, it sounds like those characters came easier, and as it rippled out further, the characters were a little harder to wrap your arms around, maybe.
I think that's right. And Ray, the guy who wrote the book on which the novel was based, was also quite hard because, you know, he was a Vietnam vet. He was very unlike me. So that was, you know, again. But I just thought, okay, you know. I mean, part of the fun of being a writer is that you do get to be not you.
Yeah.
I mean, the real joy of it is you go to your desk and you're somebody else for a day or whatever. You're just somebody else. And that was just a huge pleasure.
It's a relief, yeah.
Oh, relief, I know. I've been myself for quite a while now.
Right.
So, you know. And I always think of that when people say, oh, you know, desk and you're somebody else. Men can't write from women's point of view and blah, blah, blah. Of course you can. I think your imagination can allow you to do that. That's sort of the point.
Yeah, right. And there's so...
I've been myself for quite a while now.
So much of... You, I mean, I assume that little kernels of you are in all of these people, but you can really create a whole different person just out of a tiny seed of yourself. You know, that if you, I don't know, you scatter yourself all over the place, you don't know what will grow. I'm going off on an odd analogy.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And also, you know, because so much of it is about actors and the stage, I mean, I know a few actors. I don't know a lot of actors, but I know a few actors. And one of the things that's so interesting to me about them, I mean, people who are observant are always interesting to me because I feel that that's such a necessity for being any kind of artist, really. And And the way in which they watch people, and they watch little gestures and little ways of walking, the way in, you know, thinking of how that can be used at some point when they have to play a character, I felt that something similar was going on. I mean, when I was writing a certain character and I would go out into the world, I was looking for those people. I was looking for those people and seeing how they walked, how they talked, how they dressed, and what I could use and what I could observe of them.
That sort of leads me to the question about how helpful it is to live in New York when you're a writer, because the ability to observe on the subways or on the streets, California is so, you know, we're all very isolated and we stay in our cars and we don't go outside. We don't stand in our yards. And I was thinking as a writer, it would be what a rich palette to live in New York. And I know you've set novels all over the place. The last one we talked about was set not only in Paris, but kind of, you know, a chunk of it in Paris. And I was wondering how it feels to write about the place you're inhabiting versus writing about places you aren't, and, you know, kind of talk a little bit about your settings.
Well, I, you know, the fact is that I spend more time in the country now. We have a place in the Hudson Valley. I spend more time there than I do in the city. I mean, the city is, New York City is, I am more and more crowded, I have to say. And, you know, it's like being on the freeway all the time, except you're walking instead of in your car. So so there's that. But, and it used to be easier to observe things. I mean, now I get on the subway, and everybody's so deep in their devices that there's a lot less to observe than it used to be.
Right.
But you know, it is very helpful. I mean, it's nice to be able to see people and you know, just watch them and or sit in a cafe. I mean, when I used to teach writing in colleges, universities, I would say, like, you know, go to the coffee shop and just shamelessly eavesdrop on the people at the next table and just, you know, train yourself to remember it and write down what they say. I mean, you hear the most amazing things.
Yeah.
So there's that.
I was talking to a writer the other day who said she lives in L.A. and she said she thinks she's dumber in L.A. than any other. And she said, you know, if I was living in New York or really anywhere else, I wouldn't be this stupid. But she said, I feel like I've been dumbed down by living here. And, you know, what I'm concerned about looks and, you know, social scene, I wouldn't be concerned about if I lived somewhere else. I thought, I wonder if that's true. I don't know. But
I don't know. I love L.A. I mean, my son lives in L.A., so I come out there quite a lot to visit. I love it. I mean, for one thing, it's physically beautiful in a way that New York isn't so much anymore. But also, you know, because so many things, I mean, not downtown, are in strip malls and one level, I mean, you still find little ethnic restaurants and little mom-and-pop stores and little antique stores and so forth and little botanicas, which are becoming increasingly rare in New York because, you know, glass and steel condos are kind of just taking over block by block.
Yeah.
So LA is fascinating to me. You know, the mountains that go up in the hills and so forth. I you know, maybe if I lived there, I wouldn't think it was so interesting, but I find it endlessly interesting when I'm there. I wrote a piece for the Times about eating our way from one end of Sunset to another, to the other.
Oh, I have to look for that. That's great.
And that's what we did. We just started at the ocean, basically, and just took Sunset downtown. And every time we passed someplace that looked like an interesting place to eat, we would just stop. And it was great.
Oh, I got to read that. And then I got to follow your path. That sounds great. my guest today is Francine Prose. The book is Mr. Monkey. I have to ask, I mean, you've written so much. As you look across all of it, and I haven't even read a fraction of what you've written, but, you know, I've read a chunk of it. Do you see kind of the same themes and areas of interest and all of that rippling through across all of your work? Or do you feel like you just kind of drop anchor and explore and then pick up anchor, move, and then drop anchor again?
Well, it turns out I have certain obsessions, but I didn't, you know, that I don't know about them until I start reading my own work or, you know. I mean, for example, I wrote a novel about a theater troupe that came out in 1974, The Glorious Ones, which was subsequently made into a musical. So that was my second novel, and somehow it wasn't, I mean, somebody else pointed out to me that this is my second novel about the theater, and I went, no kidding. I mean, I really hadn't thought about it. And, you know, I've written two novels about nannies who can't drive.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I think because through most of my child-raising years, I felt like a nanny who couldn't drive. I mean, I can't drive, And I was like their nanny, even though I was their mom. So, you know, I was putting myself into these things. So, you know, there are certain themes. I mean, inevitably, because you are putting pieces of yourself in them and the things that you can't stop thinking about. I mean, for a long time, I just found myself writing about weddings. I mean, I always like to write scenes about weddings because they're so, I don't know, they're moments of such happiness, but so often embarrassing things happen that, you know, I would find, I mean, not so much anymore, but now they're more carefully orchestrated, I think. But I used to write about that a lot.
I love it. I don't know, I've been to some pretty embarrassing weddings. I don't think I've ever been through a wedding that something awful hasn't sort of happened, but it just depends on how much attention people would pay to it.
I wear sunglasses to weddings, just in case.
Just in case.
You never know.
It could be like Joy Williams and wear sunglasses everywhere you go, and then you.
Yeah, in case you start to cry or not.
Right. Just stay incognito all the time.
I say they're prescription. They are.
They are. We should all wear sunglasses all the time. I love that. I was also interested, I know you don't teach writing anymore, but you do teach literature, and your whole reason for not teaching writing anymore, I think you were talking to a former student and saying, you know, I just don't want to kind of break writers' hearts anymore or something.
It's so painful.
Yeah, it's so painful.
It's so painful.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was so over-identified with whoever, you know, the writer whose work was being talked about. My heart would just break for that person. I mean, teaching literature, it's the writer is not in the room. More often than not, they're dead. They don't care what we're saying about their work. And also, I don't have to critique it. I mean, I feel much more like a kind of cheerleader for literature. I'm not saying what's wrong with it. I'm just saying, look, this is great, and here's why I think it's great, which is a much more obviously positive way to talk about things we've read.
Yeah, right. Well, on that note, I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you give a little advice for writers, even if you... This is the best of both worlds, because you don't have to critique anyone, but you can give some of your writing advice.
I don't know. I think that you have to be... A couple of things. First of all, I think you have to be tremendously resilient. I think to do any kind of art, you have to be driven, and you have to be resilient. I mean, I also think if there's anything else you like to do, do that other thing. Because it's not an easy life. I mean, you're alone for, you know, 10 hours a day, 12 long periods of time. You have to like your own company a lot. You have to be able to live without stimulus from the outside for, you know, even. So all of those things, I mean, if you have another talent, go for it. I mean, I think the only reason to write is if you just can't stand not to write. If you're driven to it for some reason and you just... It's the thing that makes you happy, and it's the thing that makes you feel satisfied. That's the reason to do it. It's certainly not for the money, and certainly not for the, like, fast, you know, glamorous career lifestyle. It has to be for the work itself.
The one thing I have to say about writing, as opposed to other forms of art, is at least you get to create a cast of characters who can hold your interest, maybe more than actual characters out in the world. So you get to be kept company a little bit more than, you know, like a painter who's really, really alone with his sunflowers or whatever.
You know? I know, you have all these imaginary people talking to you.
Right,
in
exactly.
In fact, that's why I always find it really sad to finish a book because they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, they've been talking to you for all that time, and then you go to your desk and they're not there anymore.
Both as reader and writer. Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Francine Prose, go ahead.
Good. No, I mean, the other good thing, it depends how one feels about collaboration. I mean, you know, working on a film or doing even a screenplay, you have to realize that what gets up there is not the thing that you might have intended, whereas a novel, it's all yours. You can kind of do what you want.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, any collaborative work, you really have to make concessions and give in a little and compromise, and that's not right. Always what artists are so great at doing, I think.
In the theater, too, for sure.
Right. For sure.
You know, Mr. Monkey proved.
Right. Oh, this is always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Francine.
Oh, thank you so much. I had such a good time.
That was Francine Prose. The book is Mr. Monkey. It is out and available now. It is published by HarperCollins. Tell us where we can find you online, too, because, I know you're on tour right now, but I know people will want to know where you are.
I don't have a website.
No, you don't have a website. You're the only one.
You can reach me at my Bard website, prose@bard.edu. People can reach me. That's my public address.
Oh, that's good. And I have a list of your book tour dates here. I will list them. I will list them after the show. Wonderful.
Great.
Thank you so much.
That was Francine Prose on Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned. Uni is coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.